You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Break It Down Podcast, Downers. My name is Matt Carter, and I'm welcome you to the show. You may be a new listener, and you probably just showed up to hear JB from August Burns Red. And that's because he's quite popular. He's quite a good guitar player. He's quite a good friend of mine. And also, this episode is just freaking phenomenal. It was easy. It was smooth. It's so much fun to get to talk to somebody about something technical like gear, guitar, pedals, in-ear monitors, traveling, touring, all those things. And JB is a great guy. I'm sure you guys are familiar with his band, August Burns Red. Check him out. Follow him on Instagram and that kind of thing. And I hope you enjoy this episode. If you're new, again, welcome. Go to breakitdownpod.com. You can see my website there. And I hope you will just subscribe on iTunes. And if you like the show, check the other episodes out and tell a friend about it. This show is sponsored by Casper Mattresses. And let me tell you why Casper is so good. They're a sleep brand that created one perfect mattress that sold directly to consumers. So basically, they've eliminated the commission-driven inflated prices that go along with, you know, normal mattress companies. So it's an award-winning sleep surface that's developed in-house. It's got a sleek design. It's delivered in a small, how did they do that, you know, kind of size box. Also, they offer adaptive pillows and soft, breathable sheets. They make good sleep stuff. I've been sleeping on a Casper mattress for almost 2 years now, and I freaking love it. I sleep great. I sleep better than I ever have before. They have a great quality and a great deal, and this is what I recommend everybody sleep on. You spend like, I don't know, half your life sleeping, don't you? You should get a mattress that you really like and that you really care about. It's an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. It's got supportive memory foam. It's got a combination of different supportive memory foams, in fact, to create an award-winning sleep surface with just the right sink and just the right bounce. You know what I'm talking about. With over 20,000 reviews, and the average is 4.8 stars. So you don't have to go look that up. I'm telling you right now. 20,000 people averaging 4.8 out of 5 stars. So it's obviously quickly becoming the internet's favorite mattress. So the best part is free shipping and returns in U.S. and Canada. And you can try Casper for 100 nights risk-free in your own home. So you've got nothing to lose. If you don't love it, if you don't feel the same way as I do about it, they will pick it up and they will refund you everything, easy and painless. So this thing is designed, developed, and assembled in the USA. And all you got to do is go to casper.com/down and use the promo code down. So you get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/down and then use the promo code down. And that's, again, you'll be sleeping well and you'll be supporting the show when you do that. All right, that's all I got. Oh, I'm sorry. Emory's got tour dates. So if you live on the West Coast, go right now to emorymusic.com and come see us for $10. We're going to be going from Portland down through California into Phoenix next week. So go to emorymusic.com and come see Emory on tour. All right, let's talk to JB.
Break it down, Dada.
Break it down, oh, break it down. Break it down, oh, break it down. Break it down, oh.
I'm ready to roll when you are, Matt.
Well, that's what we're doing right now. We're rolling. So now you can officially, I told you to hold off, but now you can officially ask me how I'm doing.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing good, man. How about you?
I'm doing well, too.
I like your where you're sitting. I you see the guitars in the background and everything. What is that, your office or what?
Yeah. I actually recently got moved to the basement where I'm sitting. Used to be a ping pong table set up here. And my wife is pregnant, so the room I was using has been turned into a nursery.
Right. I meant to tell you, congratulations on that.
Oh, thanks, dude.
Very good. I remember you way back when you were just a single guy, just out patrolling all the time.
Just patrolling. Yeah, you know me.
No, not at all. But when did we meet, JB? I want to just try to jog my memory. I'm glad to catch up with you today, so we'll spend a little time doing that. 2009. Well, see if you can help me remember it.
It was the Under Oath tour.
That's when we met.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's when we met.
That or a fest. I was thinking it was maybe at a festival right before that or something. But yeah, about 2009 that was. I was thinking about that. That we tell the story. It comes up on the Bad Christian podcast a lot. The story we tell about the day we were in wherever that was in McAllen, Texas, with Under Oath, and they were having that really bad day. Do you remember that one?
Yes, and you put balloons in their bus.
Yeah, that one. That story comes up all the time, and how mad they got that we put balloons in Brent's bunk.
The reaction wasn't great. It didn't go as everyone was hoping.
They, it was weird because we were just trying to lighten the mood because they were having a horrible day. Gillespie went to the hospital for something hypochondriac related, and they were having problems with the promoter. And Brent, the TM, was just having a really, really – Brent, their TM, not Brent from your band, was having a really, really rough day, like really bad. Yep. And we stuffed his their bunk full of balloons, like just happy balloons that we had, and thought that would be funny. Though. Like, oh, now something real bad's happened. My bunk's full of balloons, and it was not received well. They were having a stressed-out day. We were trying to lighten it. They got so mad.
That was great. And of all places, McAllen, Texas.
Mm-hmm. That was the Christmas time tour too, wasn't it?
Yep, it was in December.
Yes.
And you guys were doing like, you were coming out to White Christmas.
That's right.
Acapella.
Oh yeah, we'd sing a White Christmas and we were wearing like Christmas pajamas to play in and stuff like that.
Yeah. Christmas trees on the stage every night.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, that's right. I enjoyed doing that. When you're playing with bands like Under Oath and August Burns Red, you have to do something to stand. You're not going to be tougher. You're not going to be heavier. You're not going to be louder. You're not going to be more technically proficient. So you might as well do something to stick out and be a little goofy. Is kind of
my mindset. Just be more entertaining.
Yeah,
which
be
is
more entertaining. You know what? On that tour, now we'll move into talking about gear and guitar stuff. That's what I really want to do today. Although free to talk about anything you want. If you want to just start with talking about Trump, we can do that too. On that tour, I remember, and you may not remember this, but I remember on that tour, I was trying a bunch of different goofy stuff. I'd been recording a lot, and I'd been using amp simulators and things like that. And I took a Sansamp PSA 1.1 rack thing, and I didn't even take a guitar amp on that tour. I remember I didn't really enjoy it that much, but it was just an experiment kind of for me. I didn't take an amp, nothing, and just used two of those and was the only guitar, and it was only mixed out of monitors and stuff like that. And I remember Tim from Under Oath laughing his head off at me pretty much every night. But I thought it was a pretty neat experiment, and I think it went overall pretty well. But I abandoned it. I'd been doing, and that was about 2009. Since then, I've noticed you and a bunch of other people have made more and more moves toward amp simulators and virtual amps, mm-hmm. and I know Brent was playing a Kemper and stuff like that. So I wanted to start there and talk about that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you were actually on the cutting edge of that, dude, because you were just running a DI signal
right
to the front of house, right?
Yep. And then I'd have to get them to mix in monitors just so I could hear myself. I just thought it was just an experiment for me. I'd done a million tours, and I'd been using that and enjoying it in the studio. I thought, could I pull this off with no gear? And I did, but ultimately I didn't continue to do it. But tell me about that. Go ahead.
Didn't even bring an amp as a plan B.
No plan B.
Just rolling dirty. So Brent and I are both running digital amps now. Like you said, he's using Kemper. I'm using an AXEFX XL Plus.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny you mentioned the DI thing because we're leaving for tour in a week and I'm running a DI signal to front of house for the first time ever. I did it back in 2012 with an old AXEFX and I never got a good tone dialed in. It kind of like soured me on the whole idea for a little mm-hmm. while, but I've gotten back into the AXEFX since I started using it again in 2014. But I was just miking a cab, running my AXEFX through a mic'd cab, and I've been doing that for years now. But I think our front of house engineer and I finally got my presets and patches dialed into a place where we're happier with the tone coming from my DI signal than we are coming from the mic'd cab. So when we AB them, and it actually sounds a lot better, the DI signal than the mic'd cab. So I'm finally taking the plunge and going full DI.
So how did you get, what's the reason? I want to talk more about the technicalities of what that is and how it works, but how did you even arrive at moving that direction in the first place? Why not just, what were you playing before? You played 5150 and dual rectifier some, or what did you have before?
5150 forever, to be honest. Mm-hmm. That's what I played. I mean, I still love that amp. We still use it in the studio. I eventually moved to a 6505 plus, which is just the 5150 plus, but blah, blah, blah. I love that amp, but it was a real pain to, basically my rig was getting too complex with all the pedals and the patch switching that I was having to do, mm-hmm. that I needed something, I needed a simpler solution. So I was using this, this MIDI switching hardware piece called the RG16, made by a company called RJM Music. I think it's now called the Rack Gizmo. And basically what that was a big, it was a pedal looper that also controlled the function switches on my amp. So I could hit one button and have it, you know, button one on my MIDI switch would be programmed for switching my amp to clean while turning on my compression pedal, my delay pedal, my reverb pedal. I could set it to whatever I wanted. Yeah. And I was rolling with that for a long time. You know, I had a rack shelf with like eight pedals.
So all your pedals were back in your amp rig, not in front of you.
Yeah.
Right.
For most of them were. And then I had a MIDI switcher on my board up front. Mm-hmm. And the problem with that was that I would run into issues traveling overseas. Whenever I'd fly like my B rig of that, it would just get thrashed by baggage handlers and TSA. And, you know, I get my rack off of the baggage claim at an airport and open it up, and my pedals are just like all over the place. And it became kind of an obsession for me to like get this thing working where I could fly it and it wouldn't get destroyed by people throwing it. And I never quite got it there, and it started to malfunction live, and I was really reliant on everything working perfectly, and it just...
Because if something goes wrong there, you can't reach down and bypass a pedal by pulling out a George L and putting it, skipping the tube screamer and going right to the delay or anything. I mean, back covered up in the rig. You can't even see it. You can't troubleshoot it, all that.
Endless cables. Yeah. Just a massive... I mean, I try to like zip tie them together as best I could, but it was a mess. Mm-hmm. It was messy. I mean, it was a good solution when I was at home in the States, and I was able to take like my big stack of, you know, 2-amp heads and the 12-space rack and all my stuff. But I just couldn't pull that off in Europe. It was too much gear, and I couldn't fly it all over.
What were the pedals that were in that? If you could remember specifically,
yeah,
like
remember.
What's a normal chain for you analog way?
Yeah, I had in the effects loop. I had a Boss DD7 delay pedal, mm-hmm. a Boss RV5 reverb, and those might have been the only effects pedals that I had in the effects loop. Everything in front was, I had a compression pedal. It was a Maxon compression. I forget what the exact one, little black guy. Yeah. And I had an Ibanez TS-9 overdrive pedal. Mm-hmm. I had a T-Rex octave pedal. It was purple. I can't remember exactly what it was called. Octaver, maybe. Mm-hmm. Sick pedal, though. It sounded awesome. And I had a 10-band EQ by, I can't remember who made it. It's a pretty common, you know, EQ pedal, though, that I used on my clean channel. That's all I can remember right now.
Mm-hmm. And then I imagine you noise suppressed or gated somehow.
Oh, yes. I had a noise gate, and that was also racked up. I used the Boss gates, too. Yeah, it was just on that pedal shelf with all my pedals.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I powered everything with for a while I was powering everything with the Voodoo Lab pedal power too. But that didn't do voltage switching, which became a real headache when we went overseas. Mm-hmm. So I started getting into T-Rex power supplies. I was using a fuel tank for a while.
All you had to do is, they can take 220 right into it just with the...
You just flip a switch.
Flip the switch, that's right. Yeah.
Yep. Which was crucial. But now I feel like all the gear I have, like in my current rig, I don't even have to flip a switch. Like it just takes whatever voltage you put in it, which is really convenient.
Okay, so you're doing all that and you're having problems with it. And then meanwhile, you might have been... there's been a lot of people in the meantime. I've seen the rise of Axe FX be a real popular thing in heavy music. So you were seeing other bands using that and pulling it off live? Like how did you get influenced to start going that direction? Because Kemper's a whole different thing. Kemper... if people don't know, Kemper is an amp and signal chain model or emulator where you manually go through and mic up a signal chain and an analog amp and analog pedals and record the sound into it, and then it sends it back which is very cool. And we used a Kemper on almost our whole last record for almost all the guitar sounds, but tons of different amp captures in there. But the Axe Effect is just a native processing pure thing that does the amp, does the pedals and the cab emulations all in processing.
It does anything you want. And you can even do amp capturing like the Kemper.
Oh, it does that too.
It does. Yeah, it does. It does it all. I've never done that. I mean, I'm using a factory amp that I've EQ'd the way I like it.
But, so you started seeing people out on the road with those? Like, where did you get into that?
Yeah, they were getting popular. Our buddies in Between the Buried and Me started using them, and I've been like one step behind them always as far as gear goes. They're the ones that told me about the RG16 and, you know, my RJM Mastermind foot switch, and I got that whole idea from them. And then they graduated to Axe Effects, and I was like, well, maybe I should check this out. And I got one in 2012 after I tinkered around with it for a while, and I took it on a tour in Southeast Asia and Australia. And that's the first time I was running just a DI signal, and I did not have it dialed in well at all. Sounded really digital, just didn't sound real. I was never happy with it. Our sound guy wasn't happy with it out of front of house, and I sold it to a buddy at home as soon as I got home from that tour. And then, like I said, I switched back after doing my analog thing for a few years and having it get destroyed by TSA and baggage handlers and stuff. But I mean, we were touring with like every metal band we went out with, it seemed like they were using digital amps, and I was like really stuck in my old ways with all my analog rig. I had spent so much time and money building thing out. So it was like a big commitment to like just abandon this.
But it's more than that. It's not just the time and the money commitment. There's a purity aspect to it that I want to get to. Like, I mean, there's a philosophy, there's a philosophical like whole, it's just a whole thing there. I mean, like you enter into DSP and processing for rock, you know, guitar, for heavy metal and rock guitar. Something about that many people oppose, and I think anybody that's being honest has to admit that's a new. What are we? At some point, you got it. You just go, wait a minute. What are we doing? What's going on here? Like, it's a little bit weird, isn't it?
It is weird, but I think it's important to remember that if you get stuck, I mean, things evolve and change and improve always, and music and guitar amplification and pedals and it's no different. I mean, I gave this example to my buddy recently. He was complaining that we were talking about the commissioner of baseball talking about adding for extra innings, putting a runner on second base.
Yeah.
For starting extra innings. That's just something they're talking about to try to move the game along.
So we don't have so many 15 inning games and go until 2 in the morning. Yeah.
Because 15-year-old kids who are stuck on, you know, their attention spans are shorter and they want the games faster, and it's important to keep the next generation involved. Anyways, my buddy's like, oh, that's so dumb. Like, I hate that rule. You know, they have to learn how it was. It's the old way or the highway. And I'm like, dude, like, would you be stoked if Apple stopped making iPhones after the first one? Like, you just want the original? Or like, would you be stoked if we just were still riding around on trains everywhere and no one developed cars? And so things improve and technology pushes forward, and music is no different.
Well, there's a parallel there with baseball and music. Baseball is probably the most of any sport that is like that. They don't want to mess with it. There's a lot of purists. It's about the history and the culture more. You know, NFL changes the rules every freaking year to make sure, you know, all the time. And they need to, and they're successful because of it. Because it's not, things don't stay the same anyway. You bring up a good point, because things don't stay the same anyway. That's a rule I use for everything. If podcasting, music, your marriage, whatever it is. Nothing stays the same. It's just a matter of do you want to be in charge of it or not? Do you want to be driving? It's going to change no matter what. Do you want to be driving or not? But baseball is really bad about people not wanting to change. And music is too. People in music are, they say it's about something or some purity that I can't ever find the basis for. If you go back, everything was invented. Everything was evolved. Distortion, for instance, is unnatural, isn't it? And then at some point we act like, oh, amp distortion is real. Well, it wasn't until it was.
Right.
You know?
That's very true. But it's like, get on board or get left behind,
That's right. That's a good way to say it.
Yeah. Now, I'm not saying everyone who's playing a Marshall needs to go buy an Axe FX or a Kemper and abandon what they're doing. But I also don't think that the people who are more keen on playing a tube head, they need to understand that, sure, that can be for them, but it's also fine if other people are using these newer technologies that really sound pretty darn good. Mm-hmm. I mean, bands are recording albums with them and you wouldn't even know. Mm-hmm. So,
The thing that I always felt was weird in that whole ball game is the cab emulation and then the mic cab. So the bizarre thing about a guitar signal chain is, if you think about it, if you just want to trace the whole evolution, we'll just do that real quick. I mean, there was just these guitars, and they were simply acoustic guitars or archtops. And then they were trying to amplify them or put mics on them or whatever, and then they eventually did. And then the first electric guitars were just supposed to sound like acoustics, but they unfortunately couldn't recreate it. And you have that really plinky, clean, happy little sound like Les Paul and Mary Ford or something, you know, that kind of sound, which is pretty neat. It's super clean and real plinky. And then it got to be louder and louder, bigger and bigger stuff, and then people start to drive those amps harder and harder, and then distortion and gain were really unfortunate byproducts of that process that people didn't like, except for it got to be part of the sound, and then that's what people started liking. I played my guitar for my grandpa one time, and he said, no, something's wrong. Your speaker's broken. It's got a hole in it, because I was using distortion. He said, your speaker's broken. You need to get, you know, that's what he kept telling me. I had a hole in my speaker. But to him, that sounded wrong, and it was not right or whatever. But to me, that's the exact sound I was going for. And then Now we start using processing chips and pedals to make distortion, even before it even goes to the amp, and so on and so forth. And then the weird thing about guitar is it goes through into the cab and out of the speaker, which changes it unbelievable. It's probably the biggest transformation almost of a sound. Like a DI, if you plug the line out of a head into a recording device, it sounds horrible, or at least it sounds unnatural, or something you're just simply not used to. But if you took your stereo and ran it through a Marshall cab and tried to play like a Dr. Dre song out of your Marshall 412, that sounds horrible too, in a different way. Like the frequency response is totally different. And so it's really hard to that. And then, on top of that, the sound we're used to hearing on guitar is a SM57 put in a specific spot on the cab, right, and then run that through a board and then outside of PA speakers. So it's, by the time it comes out of a PA speaker that you're hearing a live band play through, it's like, it's the most mangled, different, very specific, and almost random. It's almost random that it sounds the way that it does, in a way. It's not really at no point was it ever designed to be what it is. It's just what evolved.
There's a lot of hands, or, you know, a lot of people who can affect that sound in a live setting before you're hearing it as, you know, someone in the crowd, that's for sure.
And so it's somehow, so the part that gets real weird when you're trying to recreate stuff in digital is that part between the speaker and then from the speaker to the mic. That's the part that always, I feel like, gets lost, or traditionally gets lost when you're doing amp emulation. That's what I was trying to get to. But you feel like that's, and then the next problem with that is stage volume, and how do you monitor? Like, tell me about that.
Okay, well, I'm monitoring, I wear in-ear monitors, so.
I know, they're a super unnatural thing to do.
Yeah, no kidding. And that takes some getting used to, but now I can't play. Well, I could play without, but I would much prefer not to play without my in-ear monitors. So I have Ultimate Ears. That's the company that made my in-ear monitors. They're sick. And we run all of our lines go into an X32, which is just a little rack unit console that you run all the lines into. And then we control our volumes with an iPad, actually. Mm-hmm. Which I think a lot of bands are doing now. It's a cheap, portable solution to,
mix your own wedges or in-ears with it,
Yep. And, you know, what's awesome about that is you know, you play a show in Philly and, you know, you got your mix all dialed in, it sounds sick. Go to the next show the next night in Baltimore and you don't have to touch anything. You know, if everything is set already, so you just... I don't hardly ever touch my in-ear mix, which is nice. I mean, the only thing I might adjust is like turn my volume up of just my guitar, like slightly in my ears, or turn it down slightly. I mean, I'll go weeks without touching.
That's amazing.
touching my mix.
Are you using stage volume at all? Do you have cabs on stage or powered speakers in the back line or what?
We do. And like I said earlier, my cab has always been mic'd, and I'm just now on this next tour, I'm rolling with a DI signal instead. But even more so, my mix should be changing even less now because we're eliminating another variable in the mic, because that mic gets taken off every night when you pack up and then it gets put back on. And if it's not in the exact same spot, your tone will change slightly.
Yeah, if it's angled different, it sounds way different.
Right. So now that I'm going to be running that DI signal straight into my in-ear monitors, I mean, my tone is going to be the same every single night. And there's no tube variance, you know, your amp, I guess, technically could sound a little different from day to day, your tube amp. Not that I'm not saying that I have an ear to hear those nuances, but I guess that's the thing. So there's a lot of consistency in the way we're running our live monitoring, which is really nice.
And so what is the stage volume then? Why do you need, what do you use? Do you use guitar cabs or power speakers? And what's the point if you have in-ear monitors?
Well, the point was, obviously, I was miking it, and that's what was getting sent to front of house for forever. I mean, until, like I said, this upcoming tour. The point, in some venues, there is no point to running a live cab. I'm running a Mesa Boogie recto cab. Mm-hmm. That's what I've always run. I love them. Depending on the tour and what our backline setup is, I'll be running either a 212 or, you know, a 412. And I guess if you're playing like some big 2,000 cap theater with a great PA, there's no point in having a live cab on stage because no one's going to hear it. But if you're playing like a 500 cap club and there's no barricade and people are right up against the stage and, you know, some people might even be a little bit in front of where the PA is, you know.
Yeah,
then you might want a little stage volume just to fill in that sound for the people who are in up close.
Yeah.
And I think that's important. And it's, you know, it's kind of cool. I think stage volume is cool. I know our sound engineer would say otherwise. I mean, the less sound on stage, the easier it is for him to mix with perfect clarity through the PA.
That's true, but that's only if you have your sound engineer or a really good one that's consistent and whatever. It's one of the most bizarre things in the world to either stand, first of all, to play or to stand side stage and watch a band play with no stage volume. Now, it theoretically gives the front of house engineer more control, but it is like, it's like a weird, it's like you're in a weird dream. Like, you know, you're in a dream where you're trying to punch and you can't, or, you know, it feels like that. It's like you're not, because you have this thing where you think you take your pick and guitar playing is so physically nothing. It's like this. It's the least physical thing possible, but you have this strong association with like palm muting and a big rig and your jeans blow back against your leg and you feel like it's boom, yeah. Like you feel like you're doing something powerful. And then when you take the stage volume away and make it just a little thing in your headphones, it's like ding, 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 click, 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 click. Like the heaviest music in the world. It's just the most, feels like a bad dream. Like bullets fall out of your gun or your teeth are falling out. That's what it feels like to have no stage volume from that power that you are used to having or you associate with the thing. I saw Jimmy Eat World, the first band I ever saw that was side stage for a Jimmy Eat World show somewhere. And it was way back. It was probably 2008. And they just had their amps in isolation boxes. They had real amps, but they were soundproofed with already pre-mic'd inside or something like that. And I was just kind of devastated, like watching Jimmy Eat World with, I could hear the sound coming out of the mains over there and there was nothing from the stage. And I was so disappointed with what that felt like or meant. Like you had this vibe of the band blowing the doors off the place, but they were making almost no sounds at all. It was sad.
Hey, now they're running DI'd Axe-FX's.
Are they?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they were ahead, I'm sure, on that. And it makes sense, of course. I mean, I get it, but it's a little bit weird. But I mean, I like trying stuff like that. I'm not against it. I don't hear me wrong. I'm not against it. I think you got to keep moving and I'm into it for sure.
Yeah, it's just a different way of doing things live. And I think that it's super one thing that I love about it is how portable everything is. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't have this huge rack anymore. I have like a little 8-space rolling rack that is not cumbersome at all. And when we go overseas, like I have a Pelican case that
Gosh, yeah, that's good stuff. Yeah, I mean, people have started traveling with the little tiny terrors and stuff like that, you know, yeah. just ways to fly, because flying's the worst. And that weans you off of caring about your gear in a way. And it's a little bit weird, I mean, because you can be really into gear, but there's some level that you transcend gear. There's a phase most people go through of de-emphasizing gear, and there's all kind of range of philosophies across that. But I recently read a Tom Morello article. He got a lot of backlash and trouble. Do you know the one I'm talking about? He just wrote an article or did an interview that was written up in an article about his strong stance is, and I love the boldness of it and the point it makes, that gear never matters ever at all in any way. He puts it, and that's not his direct quote, but it doesn't matter at all about gear, period, is what he says. And I thought that, did you read that article?
No, I thought you meant, do I know who Tom Morello is?
Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine, who you certainly know who he is. But in this article, he said that, first of all, he's played just a Marshall head and cab 412, and that whatever guitar he has, a Kramer, some weird guitar he has. It's the only really one he ever plays. And it's quite interesting because he's known as an innovative guitar player, but he says gear doesn't matter. Now, some people hammered him and criticized him and said, but you use that whammy pedal. Like, what? You couldn't make that sound if you didn't have that whammy pedal, but it's just one pedal. It's a Digitech whammy pedal into a plain amp with no channel change. And he says that that's the gear he had. Therefore, that's the gear he wrote on. And he said it would always be inefficient to spend time thinking about acquiring, buying, learning how to use gear. That time would matter-of-factly always be spent better on him working on the music itself, playing guitar, practicing, trying to come up with new stuff. That's how he arrived at that. He would never think about gear, he said. So I have some gear. This is it. And any time I spend on anything other than music is a waste of time. Always better put into the creative is what his point is, which I really like.
That is a very minimalistic approach.
Yeah. But it goes on a little further than that, and I really admire it, and I like both sides, you know what I mean? Like, I'm on both sides of this because I love gear, but, you know. He says that he had to fly somewhere one time, and they had backline, there's nothing he could do about it, and he thought it sounded horrible. But then he said, he thought about that for a minute and said, if that would have been the gear that they would have given him when they started Rage Against the Machine, interestingly, he says, well, I would have just used that and I would have written differently because of it. Like, if it sounds thin when you do this, then I wouldn't have done that. I would have written into and leaned into what that did, and I would have found that, and then I would have done something awesome with this gear, and then it would have sounded exactly the way it was supposed to.
Maybe you would have done something awesome, but maybe not.
I mean, that's an extreme way to look at it, but he's just saying, like, if you have a clarinet and you don't try to use it to make a, you know, whatever, a big sound that it doesn't make, it does what it does, and then you get really good at it, and then you'll be in good shape. Yeah. And so in that regard, he's become even more innovative than most guitar players, because he's not sitting there worried about how to get the delay mod on the whatever from China and put in, you know, all that. He's not wasting all his time doing that kind of stuff.
It is a waste of time.
And he has a sound that you hear and you know it exactly like that. So it's all about style. Stevie Ray Vaughan, nothing. Strat into the whatever Fender, DeVille, whatever he played, never going to think about that again. But you know him when you hear him, no matter what.
Sure. But I think that also comes down to what you're playing on the guitar and how you write as much as your gear. Mm-hmm. I mean, those are huge factors as well.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, of course, it's like, you know, depending on your style and what you do. But I think the more the time goes on, the biggest compliment that I would want to receive is, regardless of what gear I'm playing, oh, that sounds like Matt. Like, that's it. Do you remember learning to play guitar and thinking about how Billy Corgan has a style, or these people have styles, and you're like, wow, that's so Jimi Hendrix, sounds like Jimi Hendrix, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And then, like, how awesome is it that, and at that time, you, I'm sure, didn't have a style. You were just learning tab and stuff, right? And then now you sound like JB. When did that happen? I mean, isn't that so cool that, like, you sound like
know,
you,
man.
Like, I, that should be the biggest compliment ever. Like, you, and you do, by the way. But you sound like JB from August Burns Red. Like, that's, no matter what that is, that's amazing. So changing your gear all the time would almost detract from that. It seems like, not that I'm not saying you doing this digital, I'm just going both sides.
No, I know. Then the whole digital thing, I'm trying to replicate what my 5150 sounded like. I'm not trying to change my tone. I'm just trying to change the way I get my tone, I guess. But as far as like having your sound, I don't think that's something that you can even like, I don't think that's something anyone realizes about themselves. That's something people realize for you.
Yeah.
you know, someone might eventually, like, I couldn't tell you when I like fell into my sound.
No, I know you can't pinpoint the moment, yeah. But I just want to reinforce to you and congratulate you in case you hadn't realized it. You're JB from August Burns Red, and you sound like you, and we know it when we hear it, and that is awesome. Okay. I mean, that's really exciting to me, kind of reflecting on it. And in fact, I have a track, I think I have a good example that I'm going to play in a minute. But it's real weird for me if I can fly somewhere in and just say, get backline. I try to get, it's so simple. Like, I don't care what it is. I'll carry my guitar, maybe my pedals. And then I'll just show up and say, just whatever. It'll sound like me. Like, that's a feeling that I feel like a mature. I'm not trying to like show off or brag or whatever, but I'll show up, put an amp on the stage, and it'll be me. Like, that to me, it feels just super, super good. Yeah. That's kind of, plus, on the other hand, I've had to make a different set of decisions given that we don't have a front of house engineer that we've been able to develop and keep. We don't play 2,000 cap rooms. The biggest we ever play is 500, you know, those kind of things. So what we do is totally different than what you do on scale and size. But I've kind of gone the opposite direction lately, and I just play a combo amp of whatever's there, and I'm just going to go and tweak it and make it sound like me, and then I'm going to be me, and it'll be okay. And that's what I've been doing lately. I really get it. We don't use click tracks or in-ears, nothing.
Yeah.
We don't even do, not even tracks, nothing.
Such freedom.
Yeah, it's just, it's different. Like, it makes you think a different way. Like, but it's
you're a rock band. You're just playing a rock band, you know?
Yeah, it's totally different.
It's pure.
But we spent years building the big rigs and getting the click tracks and the tracks and having the interface and all the, you know, all that stuff, which is really fun too. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. I love doing, I just love, I like getting in spaces where it's difficult and I don't know what I'm doing. Now I'm, you know, paying attention all of a sudden. Like, I kind of like things to be chaotic and different all the time. So that's me.
Sure.
But to the point, let's see, we'll play a little bit of music here. To the point of you sounding like you, I'll give a really good example of that. You, I'm sure you remember, that's a dumb question to answer, but do you remember when you played on an Emery album?
Yes.
I don't know if anybody, it's not our most popular song and not even our most popular album. It's called We Do What We Want, but you were coming up, I guess y'all were in tour California, and it was like you were going to be in town, and I was in the studio working on our album. And we're like, we should hang out.
We were in Seattle, I believe.
Yeah, you were just coming up the West Coast.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, we should hang out when you get into town. And I was like, why don't you actually come in? I'm in the studio anyway. Why don't you come in and play on a track? That'd be fun. I don't know if people do a lot of collabs like they do in rap or whatever. I thought it'd be fun to have JB come in and do this. So I left a spot at the end of a song that I was arranging, and I sent it to you. You tell. How do you remember that? And I'll play the track in a minute.
Here's what happened. Yeah, you sent me like what you had so far. I don't know if it was a demo or just what you had tracked so far. And I did what I would have done with an August Burns Red song. I tabbed out what you had written into my
I thought that was so crazy that you do it that way. I wanted to highlight that. So you started by taking what I already had and you wrote it into tab on this tiny little toy laptop or something. I don't know what it was.
Yeah. It's a program called Tabitha I've been using since Thrill Seeker, back in 2005. And so I wrote out the chord progression and, you know, put a little drum beat over it.
In tab? That's how you think in tab?
Well, no, not necessarily, but it's nice. It's a good tool for me to be able to like visually see what I'm doing and, number one, remember what I'm playing. Mm-hmm. If I write something cool, I'll be like, and like tab it out quick. So then I can, you know, move on to the next part without having to like memorize how to play this part.
But most people would just record it on a handheld recorder or voice memo. So you want to put it visual into a tab. That's what I find bizarre.
Well, and I guess the reason we started doing tab was when I'd write a song, I didn't have to sit down with the rest of my band and be like, here's how you play this. Mm-hmm. I'm like, here's the tab, go learn it.
I like that.
It's like,
that's good.
It's a teacher. I mean, and we're all used to using it now. It's way easier than sitting down and trying to explain every little riff and part to someone. But anyways, for this Emery song that I played on, I tabbed it out and then I would just loop the part over and over and just kind of jam over it with my little Roland Microcube practice amp backstage. Mm-hmm. And as I, you know, figure out what I wanted to play, I'd just tab it out and then I probably sent you the Tabit demo.
Yeah, you did. And I loved it. I thought it was so cool. I was so excited about it. I had no idea what you were going to do. I just wanted you to, I wanted you to do what you would do, not what I would do. And that's how it turned out. Do you ever write directly into the tab? Do you ever start by typing the numbers into the, on the strings on tab and then listen to what it sounds like? Or do you always play it and then type it?
I almost always play it, then type it. Okay. Seldom do there's a part in a song from our record Messengers that I wrote on tour without a guitar in my hand. It's like a thrashy riff in a song called The Balance. And I really don't like this part at all anymore. I don't even know if I liked it at the time. I didn't write it with a guitar in my hand. It's an awkward part to play. It doesn't really make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And that's one example of a time I can remember just writing something out before I played it on guitar. It's definitely not, it's better to play it and then punch it into Tabit.
You look at that tab stuff, does it mean anything to you to see 14, 16, 18?
Yeah.
You know what it sounds like by looking at it in the way that somebody like me or somebody better than me looks at notation and can see, I can look at notation and see a major seventh chord. I know what it sounds like when I look at it to some degree, not perfectly. It's like reading the Matrix, essentially. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you know what it means eventually if you see it enough.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm that good at it. I feel like I can like hit play and read along and almost like play along with it too.
Wow.
Like,
that's a skill too.
Now, if it's...
That's called Guitar Hero, I think. It's like that.
I mean, if you just tab something random out and hit play and told me to play along to it, I couldn't do it. But if I'm refreshing like an old song and I can just look at the tab and be like, like that's how that breakdown goes. I can just kind of see it coming and play along to it.
I just thought that was so neat how you had it. You brought the little laptop and you sent it back to me. I was like, oh, it's awesome. And then you got it. And then you're on the tab and you sit down and we tracked it in with an emulator. We didn't use a real amp and we sat there until we got it and we did the harmony. And you know what I can't remember? I play the song live. It's really fun for me because we play the song live a bunch and I get to play this solo that is not at all in my style, but I can play, of course. And so it's really fun. I don't remember if I tracked even the harmony on the record. You probably did both parts, and then I subsequently learned it. But I'll play it for you, and you can hear as far as the Emery thing goes. It's nothing I would ever do. It doesn't sound like Emery at all. I'm sure some people never knew it was you and thought, Matt can shred, which I would never write in that style. But I get to play it live, so it's pretty fun.
You can shred. You can shred, though.
I can copy your shredding. I mean, it's not my brain doesn't think that way.
That's still shredding.
To your point there, that's a whole nother issue, but maybe shredding is one of those things that's very much where you develop a vocabulary by strict emulation and tab. Like it's less, well, it'll sound like an insult, but shredding can be less melodic. You'd agree to that, right?
Absolutely.
In that style where you're just throwing all these super fast 16th note modes on top, you know what I mean? Like it's not like you're hearing all of it.
If the song sucks, even if you're shredding over a song, but the song sucks, who cares? The song is more important than the difficulty.
Of course it is. But I find that the best musicians to me are a cello player or a jazz trumpet player or somebody who improvises and they can hear it in their head and it comes out in real time and they're hearing the notes and they're coming out in real time. Where I draw the exception is, and people like me have to arrange to get that. I can't do it. I can't improvise in real time and do all that. And you arrange too, not a knock on you. But then shredders, the knock on shredding guitar players is the ones where they learn all these licks, scales, modes, things like that, and then get super technically proficient and they just blast it out on top of something. And technically it works because they know a mixolydian on blah, blah, blah. And they're just doing it. And they're playing so fast and so from memorization and have some vocabulary, they're not hearing those notes before they play them. They're surprised when they hear it too, how it sounds in context. You know what I'm saying? That's when I go, this is not what I want to do with shredding. However, the part I'm going to play now for you, people will call shredding, it's incredibly melodic. And that's why it's badass. And that's part of the key to, that's who you are. That's what I identify as what makes JB sound like JB. You're doing stuff that people are calling shredding because it's proficient, but you take the time to arrange it and make it melodic and lyrical and thoughtful. It's not just showing off, jack off, whatever. Do you know what I mean?
It's not jack off at all.
It's not. Well, I mean, you know, somebody could accuse that here and there, but especially this part and a lot of stuff on your records, I just find it to be quite melodic. And I think that's part of the key to your success. And a tip I would give shredders, spend a little more time arranging and less on the licks. But anyway, I'll play the context of the song at the end of this would be the solo.
was the first time that I ever looked inside myself. Now the world beneath my feet is turning, turning. All this silly world keeps turning, turning.
Nice work, JB.
Thanks, buddy. Hey, you recorded it.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the easy part. I didn't even use a microphone to record. I just put it on 11 or amplitude. I don't know what simulator it was, but I think it was 11 Digi's simulator there. That whole record is all amp simulations. There's no amps on it.
Really?
Yep. But, you know, it's easier in the studio to get right. Live is where I've always had problems trying to get it to work. But it's weird. Some people use amps live and not, I don't know, there's no rules to it, and that's the rule we use in recording, at least, is if it sounds good, it is good. So
that's exactly
the way I think of it. What else you want to talk about?
I don't know, man. I have a signature guitar coming out.
Do you really? Your green Ibanez, yeah, is your design, right?
That's right, yeah. Ibanez is releasing a signature model of, I guess, my green guitar, the mm-hmm. one back here.
Yeah.
I grab it. So, I mean, it's not this one exactly, but it looks like this, and it's pretty sick. I think it comes out in, like, August soon. It's coming out soon.
Oh, yeah.
So that's exciting.
I know something else I wanted to say or pay as a compliment to you is I think a lot about this. Like I told you, I'm bad. I don't know that I'm bad on attention span exactly, but I like to do different things pretty intensely and with focus for maybe a few years at a time or months, but I don't continue to do the same thing. So as a guitar player, for instance, I always wonder, should I not be doing podcasting, try to learn recording and try to do all these other things? Should I just have gotten better at guitar for my whole life? And I think, I always think, what would my path be if I, because there was times when I was practicing guitar 4 hours a day, 5-6 hours a day, just, I didn't think of it as practicing. That's just what I was into. And that's right. How I got good at guitar. And then when I did get good at guitar, and especially got out on the road, my life changed. And then I didn't never do that again. Like, I never play guitar at all. And I always think about how wrong that is. It feels wrong. Like, I was good at it. I was able to even make a career out of it. And then I kind of stopped doing it at that level, and I wonder, for the last 15 years, what if I just made myself care about guitar primarily, not business, podcasting, recording, whatever other stuff, maybe I'd be really good, maybe I'd had a career, better career as a guitar player and stuff like that. And I always think, because, I mean, look at JB, you live and love and breathe guitar, you put those licks up on your Instagram, which everybody should follow, it makes me kind of angry at you for loving guitar so much for so long.
Well, I do love guitar, but I can't say that I'm like sitting down playing for 4 hours a day though either.
No,
at this
but
point.
You live it. Like you're still, yeah, you still, guitar is your thing still, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it is for sure. I mean, I just haven't, I guess ABR has done well for years and I haven't had a great opportunity or a break to go and try to do something else. I don't know that I really want to do anything else.
That's
either.
Right. Like, that's what I'm saying. You're not bored of it though.
Yeah. No, I'm not.
Like, from my brain, I can't, I'm not bored of guitar, but if I'm playing guitar now, I want to learn big band jazz on an acoustic and learn to improvise jazz. Like, if I was sitting down on the guitar and had free time, that's what I would be doing. But
right.
How are you not bored with it? Like, you're clearly not, and I don't think you should be. I'm just saying, from my brain, how do you not get bored of playing metal guitar?
Well, I sometimes get bored of playing metal. I say to my wife sometimes, if we're just like in the car driving and listening to something, I'd be like, oh man, like it'd be cool to be in this band.
Uh-huh.
Like, and not have to work so hard, I guess, at playing hard things. But that's something I think about. I mean, it's one of the reasons I have to play guitar as much as I do is because the stuff that I write is still hard for me, even old songs. I mean, it's still hard. If I don't practice it, then I lose it.
Yeah.
So I have to keep up with that. I mean, this morning I just was practicing for our upcoming European tour. I mean, just playing through songs that, I mean, playing through messengers.
I mean, it's your job, but you ought to be practicing. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, you should. I don't know why that doesn't click with me in that same way, but of course you should be practicing. Your damn job.
Right. It is definitely my job. And I treat it as that. And I like having, like, I take it seriously, I guess. Mm-hmm. So I want to keep up with it. And I want to do a good job and I want to play well live. And
but it's not hard. Like you enjoy it. I mean, you're like, oh crap, I hate doing this, but it's my job and I need to pay the rent or whatever, mortgage, whatever.
No, yeah. I mean, some days you don't feel like practicing, but it's definitely more fun than punching a clock at the grocery store. I mean, that's no what I was doing before I did ABR. I was working at a grocery store. So,
are you a lot better at guitar than you were, let's say, 5 years ago? Or is it all just keep, I mean, does it feel that way?
I think I'm better, but it's like.
I mean, do you think of it athletically? Like, oh, I could play this at 180 BPM and now I can play it at 198 and hope to be at 212. You know, that you don't think that way, do you? Or you do?
Well, sometimes I have to, if there's a part that I mean, every new album we do, I mean, there'll be a part that we're going to play this song live and I'll be like, oh no, like that one part's really hard. Like I need to drill this at a slower tempo and build it. And there's parts, you know, we have a new record that we just finished recording earlier in this year that, you know, we're starting to prepare some new material and stuff. And I'm having to sit down with the metronome and drill and start slow and build up again. And, that's like not the sexy fun side of playing guitar, but it's kind of necessary, especially if, like, I don't want to get on stage and blow the solo. Like, I need to practice it and get it slow and, you know, get it down.
That's what it was like when I had to play that part for the tour. Everybody's like, are you going to be able to pull it off? I was like, I'll pull it off. Don't worry. But it's still coming in one day, 2 day, the night before. I didn't really have it licked. You know, I just the day of, I'm drilling it before the first show we played that. Like, I don't normally do that with our music. I just kind of know it or whatever. But learning that, I was like, first of all, during the middle of a solo, worst. I mean, if I make a mistake in a chord somewhere, okay. But when it's me playing a shreddy solo to show off, and then you mess up, you look like an idiot.
Yeah, and it happens. I mean, it happens to all of us.
Have that happen sometimes? You'll get up there and do like brain fart or a song you haven't done in a while, or you go, oh, I'm actually unprepared on this European tour, stuff like that?
Well, I hopefully won't come to a whole tour unprepared, but if we do like a one-off show, you know, we'll be, for instance, we just did a festival up in Quebec. We hadn't played a show for maybe a month before that. And when I go into those shows, you know, I practice and we do a couple of rehearsals as a band stuff. But my mentality coming into that is like, number one, I don't want anything to go technically wrong with my stuff. Like, I don't want my wireless to cut out, or like, I just want no technical issues for anyone. And that, number one, that's like, if that happens, it's already like a good show by just like the baseline of a good show. And then number two, I'm like, just don't forget how to play any of your parts. Like if you play, maybe I'll slop through a section, but I still remember how to play it. It's not like I had to stop or anything, or like I didn't forget and stop. And if I can get through all the parts and nothing goes wrong, then chances are almost everyone in the crowd is going to go, cool, yeah, that was a good show. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not going to hear the slight nuance or the slight imperfection in my right hand while I'm tremolo picking a part if I'm not like perfectly consistent or something like that, you know.
Yeah.
Like those little details that I hear, especially because I'm wearing in-ear monitors, I mean, I can hear every little scrape of my pick crystal clear. So I'm going to be much more critical of what I'm hearing than what people in the crowd are hearing, because they're hearing everything blended together nicely the way it was meant to be heard, where I'm hearing my guitar much louder in the mix than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think if I'm satisfied, I know that the crowd will be satisfied. Yeah. Probably more than satisfied. They'll be stoked.
Yeah, as long as the other bums in your band know their parts, that is.
Right. I just, if I do my job, they'll do theirs and we'll be all right.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. You guys always did a really good job of taking your band seriously. I've always really admired that. You've kept the same crew and you stayed in a van way longer than you had to. And you guys have a super good work ethic, and it couldn't make me happier to see it pay off and stuff like that. It's just, it's awesome. Like, I guess it was only going to happen one way, and it's happened the way that it should happen and did. I'm very happy about that. If it stopped for whatever reason, what would you do next? You have any idea? Like, just say you couldn't play guitar, didn't want to, or everybody started hating metal and there was no living to be made, what would you do? You have any idea?
I'd love to.
Since you put your whole, the idea being since you put your whole life into guitar like this.
Right. I'd probably want to do band managing. That's something that I've been active in. I've been active in managing ABR since the beginning, and we're actually self-managed now. So Brent, or the guitar player, and I manage the band.
Nice.
So we have a lot of experience. Yeah, I mean, we've been doing, next year will be our 15th year as a band. So we've been doing it for a long time, and we understand how the business works. And it's, especially from just being so hands-on for so long, I'd love to get into managing other bands.
Do you manage your band and even take some pay and stuff for doing that? Is there a business deal involved?
Yeah, there is.
Cool.
There is.
That's smart to do. Sometimes people have a hard time doing that, where there's, I mean, Emory's always been a super good band of being able to, one of the powers we have that is allowed a small band like us to survive is we've been able to let different people lead and do different things in different ways. But some of those right. bands that have pure democracy, everything kind of get stifled, and bands that are able to figure out how to let certain people do certain things, it's another super smart thing. And
yeah, you know, everyone has their pros mm-hmm. or everyone has their strengths, you yeah. know, and it's not like when Brent and I took over managing, it was saving the band money, even to pay us
for
a
sure.
salary.
Absolutely.
We're saving money versus paying, you know, a traditional manager.
Yeah.
But yeah. And everyone, that's the other thing. Like managing the band takes a lot of time. I mean, if I'm not practicing, I'm still like working at August Burns Red. I'm not just like playing the Xbox.
Yeah.
There's work to be done. There's a lot of work to be done, and I enjoy that work. And I don't know that everyone else, you know, in the band would enjoy that work. And the other guys who aren't active in the management side have, you know, things that they enjoy doing. And, you know, Matt does a ton of drum lessons and stuff. And Jake has heart support right. and does a clothing line. And everyone's got their other things. So it works out well.
Yeah, that's just good.
Just want to do management.
Are you not managing any other bands, but you think you'd like to do that, or not until ABR
yeah,
slows
I don't
down?
I don't at the moment. And yeah, I mean, it's not something I'm like actively looking to like pick up bands and manage them.
Right.
I think that I'd be into it, but I also don't want to overextend myself. I think that, you know, ABR is still very busy, and we're doing a good job of staying super on top of everything on the business side. And I don't want to take on like a couple other bands and then suddenly August Burns Red starts to slip with on the business side. I think that would be foolish.
How you know, that's really weird to, you know, just to make that connection if you think about it. I talked to Tim from Under Oath a good bit, and he comes on podcast whenever, and I identify Tim and me as having similar roles in our bands that we do, where we run a lot of the business and get stuff going and arrange the music and are very particular about some of that internal stuff.
Yeah.
And then I didn't really think about it, or it didn't often always pop into my head, but we did that tour together, and you certainly are that guy in your band, you know? Like, I know the other guys contribute and write and do a lot of other stuff too, but you have that point guard kind of thing going for your band. So, and again, we were discussing arranging, and we have different methods, of course, but that's the interesting people in a lot of bands, you know, is that Tim manages other artists, and I help manage and our band and help other bands in a similar way, is doing right. artist management and stuff like that. So that's interesting how all those work together, like arranging, somewhat managing, somewhat creative, good with people. That's the similar set of skills that you and Tim and I all fall right into that category.
We should start a management company together.
Now, maybe we wouldn't get along. I think we need to be surrounded by other types. I don't know that you need a bunch of us.
I think Tim already has one. Anyways.
Yeah, Tim's doing super well with all that too. But that's interesting. Man, JB, I've really enjoyed catching up with you today.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, you can come back anytime if you want to talk about anything specific or whatever. I love thinking out loud. I love using the podcast as an opportunity to catch up with people and stuff too. So
yeah.
I'm glad for you having a baby and all that. I mean, it really is awesome to see these people I've known for 10 and 15 years sometimes go from being kids. I mean, I remember when your first record came out. I didn't meet you at that time, but I remember when you guys first had a first record. I think there's part of me that thinks of you as some new band. Some new little band coming up. Oh, whoa. Who are these kids? So, you know.
I remember you guys living at John Dunn's house.
Oh, really?
Like, talk about you guys crashing at his apartment up in Seattle. Like, he's like, yeah, it's really Emery. Like, when we were getting signed, I think you guys were still maybe in that.
That's right.
Like, living in his apartment.
Yeah, we were staying in his apartment.
Signed us to Solid State. So that is funny.
It is. It is.
We got some history, Matt.
Absolutely. We got a long way to go. Life can be long sometimes. I keep thinking, like, are we almost done here? Like, but no, I don't know what I'm doing, and I'm doing this now. That's what I'm saying when I'm asking that. I cannot imagine what I'm doing now, playing music and doing this, or what you're doing. I cannot imagine 5 years from now it's just the same, or certainly not 10. But we got a long way to go before we die, I hope. So I don't know. Right. I don't know what we're gonna do.
You'll figure it out.
I mean, we'll run into each other and keep doing stuff another decade and another. I imagine, because it's not like we're about to go work at factories. I don't think that one's gonna happen. So
that is definitely not on the plans.
Yeah. Well, onward and upward, and enjoy talking to you. Thanks, JB.
Yeah, all right, buddy. We'll see you later.
You've been listening to the Jabberjaw Podcast Network, jabberjawmedia.com.
Shh. Hi, I'm Emma.
And I'm Joe.
And we're the professional book nerds. Two Mondays a month, we interview authors and talk about their upcoming books, what drives them, and their go-to order at the cafe.
On Thursdays, we share recommendations and dive into topics readers face, like, how do I actually read the books on my to-be-read list?
You can find the Professional Book Nerds podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Want to learn more about us? Our website is professionalbooknerds.com, and you can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at ProBookNerds.
We hope you'll come and listen, and as always,
happy reading!
Ever heard of Stoicism? Chances are, if you have, you've heard of Stoicism with a lowercase s and not Stoicism with an uppercase s. Lone wolves, no emotions, antisocial behavior, cold indifference. All that is Stoicism with a lowercase s. Stoicism with an uppercase s is the ancient Greek philosophy and virtue ethics framework that centers on service to the cosmopolis, to include your family, friends, community, and planet, and the development of a good moral character. My name is Tanner Campbell, and I'm the host of Practical Stoicism, a 3 times a week podcast teaching Stoic principles and concepts to anyone interested through the exploration of texts and deep dives into various moral topics. You can find Practical Stoicism where you're already listening to podcasts by searching for Practical Stoicism or by going to stoicismpod.com. I invite you to give it a listen today. You just might like it.